Thank you for tuning in. This is Red Eyes Radio, redeyescreations.com and redeyesmembers.com. I'm Henrik Palmgren from Sweden. Welcome, ladies and gents, and all fellow seekers of authentic answers. Those of you who dare to ask questions, search, and look into topics and research that might not necessarily be the chiseled out, written in stone truth as of yet. But those who dare to investigate and inquire as a means to check and validate, those who dare to be on that journey of discovery, I think that will yield some pretty interesting results. So in other words, this is an ongoing research project, and we continue to question what we believe is the established version of events. We have a wide set of interests, and we look pretty much all across the spectrum and try to break those barriers that some others conveniently build around themselves. So that means that what you hear might not be your favorite topic every time, but we do try to make it interesting and challenging for you as well. Look at it this way. Among some of our Norse ancestors who were great explorers and navigators, there were those who sought to challenge the narrative, and when everyone was secure and safe with going east, there were a few brave men that dared to go west and discover things that no one knew before. So we can follow in these brave men and women's footsteps and discover new territory. Whether it's boom or bust, we have to try. We have to challenge ourselves. This is how we discover truth. Get out there and find out. Vincent Freeman is a molecular biologist and artificial intelligence scientist who has worked on classified programs at some of the top 50 defense contractors. He has also conducted genetic and biological analysis for the National Institute of Health, the NIH. Vincent is currently volunteering his time as a senior consultant to the Carnicom Institute, a non-profit research organization whose goal is to identify and expose covert geoengineering and bioengineering. Vincent's current project involves reverse engineering the fundamental structural biology involved in the chemtrails pathogen, and Vincent works closely with Clifford Carnicom and the staff there to accomplish this task. Our topics today is chemtrails, Morgellons, and a new discovery made regarding a new kind of synthetic or artificial life form that has been called a cross-domain bacteria. Some pretty bizarre material they will discuss in this program, but very interesting, so stay with us. Welcome, Vincent. Thank you so much for coming on with us. It's great to talk with you today. Hope everything is good on your end.
Everything's great. Thanks.
It's really interesting to have you here. I think this is going to be very interesting. We haven't really gone into this particular topic in detail. We've talked a little bit with Sophia Smallstorm about it, of course, but you have a far more, I think, scientific background to this topic and a way of kind of wrapping this in a different kind of context, if you will. But tell us a little bit about how you got onto this and a little bit about your background, Vincent, if you will.
Well, sure. I studied biochemistry as well as a discipline called bioinformatics. And what that is it's the study of how biology and computers interact, so sort of calculating biology with computers. And I did work for a while at the National Institutes of Health, NIH, doing basic sort of molecular research in microscopy, which is looking at things under microscopes, but very expensive microscopes that take up an entire room. But so I did some of that, and then I went into the defense world, into the military-industrial complex. And although I'd love to have inside info on this particular aerosol spraying chemtrails thing, unfortunately I didn't work on any of those programs in particular. But I did work on other programs at in some of these top 50 defense contractors, mostly related to the whole spying type thing on the public and aggregating social media and analyzing it and trying to figure out, population trends and how people react, mass psychology, that sort of thing. But you can sort of see by pulling back the curtain the amount of money that's thrown at control, control in all of its forms, whether it's, aerosols in the air or control of the internet, control of people's thoughts and their perceptions. So I saw that through the military-industrial complex, and one day I stumbled on Clifford Carnicom's site, and I looked up in the sky, and I realized, I had a sinking feeling in the pit of my stomach, and I realized that this was real, that that they were spraying the air. And so my journey since then was as to figure out why. And that was probably six years ago. I realized that, maybe a little more. And just recently, over the past several months, 3 months perhaps, I've decided to really, you know, go full force on this. You know, just my conscience has compelled me. So I got in touch with Clifford and am now working very closely with Clifford Carnicom from the Carnicom Institute to do the basic scientific research and to try to accelerate it. So that's sort of my background and where I'm at. And, you know, we talk every week, Clifford and I, and more than once a week. And really the goal now at the Carnicom Institute is to focus not on this geoengineering so much, not that it's not important, but to focus on the bioengineering. Because, you know, people post about HARP and, you know, weather, you know, owning the weather in 2025, which is a paper by the Air Force. And all of that is true. You know, it's not right. That it's not true. It's just that the bioengineering is really the more serious matter of the two. And it goes to the core of life itself and the process of life. So that's why I'm involved with Carnicom Institute, as well as my own research. And the goal here, I think, is we're trying to reverse engineer the structural biology of this chemtrails pathogen, if you will, and to figure out the components, its life cycle, what is it made out of, and so forth. And then down the line, you know, that's connected to more gallons, but we're looking at the, you know, smallest, most basic units of what it's made out of, not, you know, the highest, you know, nano machine, you know, type stuff it's making. We're looking at the smallest things we can to try to analyze those. So that's basically where I'm at and where the research is at.
Very good. Now, before we get deeper into this and talk more about bioengineering and kind of where this trail have led you guys and obviously what you've been finding and everything else, there is a quite interesting history overall, though, of just aerosol spraying, and that this is something that's been in effect for many, many years, different programs running. Tell us a little bit about that.
Sure. Well, this has been going on for a very, very long time. Not the aerosol spraying, the chemtrails, as people call them, have been going on around 1998, 1999, depending on who you ask, in the area of the country. But much before that, we know from declassified documents of this thing called Operation LAC, and that stands for Large Area Coverage. And what that was a U.S. Army Chemical Corps operation. And what they did is they took these aircraft, back then very primitive aircraft, they were called flying boxcars. And C-119 flying boxcars. And
wow.
They flew them all. I mean, they're not actually by, that's just a slang.
Sure, no, I got it.
but they, it's from around 1950 to the mid-1960s, they flew these things all over the United States, and they sprayed out of them something called zinc cadmium sulfide. And what that, these are just little particles. And what that is a fluorescent particle. So you would just think it was dust, essentially, if you didn't know any better. But it actually fluoresces under UV light. So they would dump this stuff out of aircraft. And to give you an idea of the scale, as they did each flight of this aircraft, they would fly for, you know, 400, 600 miles at a time, continuously releasing this stuff. And each one of these flights could release over 5,000 pounds of zinc cadmium sulfide. And so they did, you know, hundreds of these flights, you know, I think even just in a year. And they did them all over the U.S., from all the way up to Canada, all the way down south, from the East Coast to the West Coast. And the reason that they did that was, at least from the declassified documents, was to determine how biological or chemical agents would disperse according to weather systems and the jet stream and so forth. And so they had people, like covert people on the ground who would go on the ground to various places in the United States, and they would look using a fluorescent detector and try to count how many particles were in various cities and towns all over the United States. And they would put the detectors, you know, wherever they could, on roofs in people's gardens or whatever. And there's some good documentaries on this, but the whole point is that even as early as 1950, not only did they have the idea of spraying out of aircraft an aerosol, which actually is a heavy metal, for the purpose of biological and chemical warfare, they actually implemented it, and they did a very comprehensive job doing that. And just the scale of the operation of Operation LAC was vast. And it's a fact. I mean, it's nothing that can be argued with. This is all documented.
Do you think that they are using some of the data that they found even way back then to perpetuate the programs that's running today?
Oh, absolutely. I think that was the genesis of what we see today, not in the biological sense, but back then, you know, at least publicly, we don't know that they had, you know, supercomputers or anything, but I'm sure that now they can take those data sets and understand them better. But I think that was where it started. And back then they were probably using, you know, giant, you know, vacuum tube computers and pen and paper and really smart engineers to try to reverse engineer weather systems in the jet stream and how that would impact where these particles would land. And they found all sorts of stuff. They found particles that had traveled during these dispersion tests, like hundreds, even I think some thousands of miles from where they were released. So You're absolutely right. That the answer to that question is, yeah, absolutely. They use this data, and I don't know if they still use it, but certainly it formed the core of the genesis of this program, and I'm sure they used it to engineer when they started coming up with this current phase of what we see, very complex and very advanced. I'm sure that they used this information to give them an idea of how to proceed.
Indeed, and that, of course, sets kind of the groundwork a little bit for the very idea that they are involved in this kind of stuff, as we know, as those people who are been doing the research know, the usage of various, you know, chemical agents and biological warfare and even testing on you know, their own population in various countries around the world. It's not uncommon, you know, and why would we expect that this is something that would have, you know, ceased in the, you know, 21st century for some reason? That's not the case, you know?
Oh, absolutely not. And, you know, even this zinc cadmium sulfide stuff, they didn't tell anyone they were releasing it. And it's actually it's toxic, you know. Mm. And there was a whole review where Congress said, you know, oh, you know, it's not so bad for you, but it is actually toxic. It has cadmium, which is a heavy metal. It's a poison, essentially.
Yep.
It has that in it. And during these tests, they also didn't just release the zinc cadmium sulfide. They went on to release essentially bacteria as well. They released bacteria in the same family as anthrax, not actually anthrax. It's a non-pathogenic, so to speak, anthrax. But still, this bacteria that they released, it was the Psyllis strain, I think, but regardless, it was, it certainly could have made people sick, and possibly people that were elderly or frail could have inhaled this bacteria from that they sprayed in the 50s and died from it. And so they wanted their data sets more than they cared about harming the public. And
yeah.
You see that over and over. So there's a precedent for all of this.
Oh boy. So, what kind of work have you and, everyone in Clifford, including at the Carnegie Mellon Institute, been involved in? I mean, for those who don't know, you guys are releasing, you know, research papers and everything else. So maybe you can tell us about that a little bit.
Sure, absolutely. So I guess part of my task or goal here is to try to translate some of the information that we've come up with into something that, you know, the general public will be able to digest. Because there's a lot of scientific information, and you could spend your whole life trying to, you know, Wikipedia up what particular terms mean and so forth. So the latest research that has been done is involving this thing called cross-domain bacteria. And what basically the idea here is that, you know, it started out with Clifford managed to get filaments that came from the aircraft through various means, you know, by using HEPA filters on the ground. And, you know, he could speak to that. And also people actually earlier in the days when they weren't perfecting it, there were like literally they would spray too low and some of the stuff would land on a tree and somebody would pick it up with a stick, put it in a jar. And, you know, we have samples of that. So, so we have some samples that we're looking at, and it's a filament-like material is the major form. It's filaments and then smaller filaments and then smaller filaments. And then, so it's sort of almost like a fractal structure of filaments. And by filament, I mean sort of a long, narrow thread that just has more narrow threads inside of it. And it also looks like those filaments are encased with keratin, which is the sort of thing like an animal's horns are made out of, or your hair is made out of. It's a very, very tough type exterior. But as the research has gone on, Clifford has discovered that the component structure within these filaments, if you break them down, so to speak, and he spent a lot of time and effort doing that, what comes out are what these things we call cross-domain bacteria. And we call them that because cross-domain refers to the fact that they have properties of all three kingdoms of life. In life, there are basically three major divisions. There's bacteria, there's archaea, and okay, bacteria are just bacteria. They're little infectious, you know, organisms, sometimes not infectious, sometimes they are. They're single-celled. And there's archaea, which are the sort of type of life that might live on a volcanic vent at the the bottom of the ocean near a vent, you know, like near lava.
Like sulfur kind of bacteria.
Exactly. They're called archaea. They used to be thought to be bacteria, but they can digest like methane, or they can live, you know, off lava, or they can photosynthesize from the glow of a volcanic vent at the bottom of the ocean. So that's archaea. So you have bacteria, archaea, and then we have eukaryota, which is basically everything else. That would be plants, animals, fungus, your cat, your dog, yourself. That's the main category, and that's all the higher forms of life. Well, what we see is that this particular bacteria, or what appears to be a bacteria, it's very small for a bacteria. Not too small, but it's on the small size. It seems to be under about 1 micron, and most bacteria are not quite that small. That's the first thing that's strange. So it does look about the size of bacteria. It's on the small side, but it's very resistant to degradation. So, for example, you can boil it in acid or freeze it to freezing cold temperatures and then do that, put it in really, you know, like put it in Drano, you can put it in acid, whatever. And this stuff does not break down. It's absolutely fine. While most bacteria or even cells from your body, if you put that in boiling sodium hydroxide, which is basically boiling Drano, you put like some of your skin into that, you know, there wouldn't be any cells left. But these particular cross-domain bacteria are very resistant to degradation. So they seem to have properties of these extreme, you know, volcanic vent type living organisms, you know, that are very resistant to degradation. Huh. And then the other property that they seem to have is that we don't know this yet. And so this is not official Carnicom Institute position, but what it seems to me personally is that these bacteria sort of line up in a row, these cross-domain bacteria, and then they form the filament around them. And that would be sort of a fungal type structure. So that's why it's cross-domain. And of course, fungal is that third category. So you sort of have these broad properties of all three kingdoms of life, or not kingdoms, rather domains of life. So that's why they're called cross-domain bacteria. And so that's what we're focusing on, because that seems to be the smallest self-replicating component in the whole mix that they're spraying. So, you know, there are larger structures, and of course there is, you know, what appears to be more gallons and fibers and all of this that are visible to the naked eye. But we're working with the smallest structure that we can that is only visible at very high magnifications and so forth. So, because we want to get to the core of the organism and its life cycle and what it does, and so that's why we're focusing on that.
So it's a living thing, obviously, and it seems to be an interaction then between these the bacteria, the cross-domain bacteria, and the filaments themselves, that they kind of they work together in some way, correct?
Absolutely, absolutely. We're not exactly sure how, and that's what we're trying to figure out. But they work together, and it seems like, well, it doesn't seem, it's pretty strong evidence that these cross-domain bacteria start aggregating together, and then they seem to start somehow either form together to make the filament, or they build the filament, you know, almost like a living nanomachine or something. And then, you know, they're also present within the filament once it's built. And as the filament still gets bigger and there's more structure to it and so forth, they're still in there. So that's one aspect to it. Another reason we focus on the cross-domain bacteria is that they're ubiquitous, especially when we started looking at blood samples, and Clifford has a lot of papers on this, especially in people who are not trying to stay healthy and their immune systems are not in great shape or whatever. We look at slides of their blood and their red blood cells, and you can see around the edges of the red blood cell these cross-domain bacteria almost just sticking to the edges, either trying to get in or they're just bound to the edges. It's not clear why, but there's tons of microscope photographs of that. So it seems that those, as far as we've discovered, the cross-domain bacteria are the smallest living form, and by living we mean self-replicating and self-assembling. So,
is there anything else like this that we know of? I mean, to me it sounds that we're talking about something that's created and not natural.
Right, yeah. Genetic engineering is a very strong consideration for a number of reasons. I mean, the first is the fact that it has properties of, you know, all three domains of life. There's nothing known that has that. That's the first thing. But the second thing is that the fact that it's able to switch forms, that these things are able to build these higher structures and so forth. And also the fact that these agents, they seem to be infectious, but infectious in almost a parasitic way, so that, you know, you can find these things, the filaments and the cross-domain bacteria. Clifford has a paper out called The New Biology, and he's found this stuff growing in even things like potato that you eat. You know, you split it apart, look at it under the microscope, and it's got, you know, filaments and cross-domain bacteria in it. Or you take, for example, I have to stick to the published topics here, so I can't talk about anything else that's not published yet. But if we look at, here's another example. He managed to get himself a dried pig lung, okay? And he looked at that under the microscope, and once again, it's absolutely filled with these filament samples as well. So it doesn't seem, another one here is the carrot cells. You can actually see in just carrots you buy at the store, it would seem, you see these cross-domain bacteria, you know, moving around in even our food. So it seems that they've become ubiquitous. And with 15 years of spraying of this stuff, you'd imagine that they are. But they seem to be able to not only infect people, but as well as plants and animals. So, you know, it's very sort of, you know, in a sense unnerving, but at the same time, on a scientific level, it's interesting, and it does suggest genetic engineering, because this is not something that, you know, would spontaneously occur naturally. You know, it just, I can tell you a number of reasons why, but not least of which, we have lots of scientific literature going back to the 1930s, even the 1890s, and people have been taking apart, you know, pig lungs for 100 years now, and
right.
there has never been pictures of this sort of stuff. So it's new. It's new. It's come within the past 15 years. So
you guys have you're taking pictures of this, and you have that on the website for you. I mean, you sent me a pack of images as well, and there are certainly things that we can link up here on our program page if we need to do that as well. But is there anywhere you can recommend people to go right away if they want to like take a look at some of the pictures?
Absolutely. So if they want to know about the filaments in what I just mentioned, the potato, and in the he's got a calf liver. It's got that in there, and then the carrot. That would be a paper called The New Biology, and I'll actually link it on my own personal site, but you can get to it by, I believe the easiest way would be to go to Clipper's original site at carnicom.com, which forwards to the new site. So go to carnicom, carnicom.com, and that forwards you to the new Carnicom Institute page. But right there, on that page, you'll see the papers. And if you scroll down, 1, 2, 3, 4, fifth one down, it looks like, called The New Biology, that shows that these filaments and CDB bacterial structures are in all sorts of stuff nowadays, not only in us, but in our food, it seems.
So very good. I found that paper right away. We're going to have that linked up here on the program page. You guys listening can just follow along and look at that. And there's one slide there that is, of course, moving. There's a couple of frames within it, and you can actually see like a time lapse of my microscopic views there. And describe it for us. What is it that we're seeing there? How small are these things?
Well, that's a good question. And we're limited by our equipment. So Carnicom Institute is not it doesn't have a budget of hundreds of thousands of dollars in a university equipment. So everything
right.
we've done so far has been on a shoestring, and gradually that's changing. But so we can't give an exact estimate, but we can tell you that they seem to be under 1 micron in diameter. I don't know if I should speculate on the exact amount, but I would say over a tenth of a micron, but less than 1 micron maybe as a range. They're in that size range. And for reference, I believe a human hair is about 80 microns wide, if I remember right. So these things are less than 1/80th the width of a human hair. But don't quote me on that. That's just off the top of my head. But they're very small.
Right.
Very small. Most bacteria are much larger than these things. These are actually, they're not the smallest bacteria, but they're down there as some of the smaller ones. And so we're not sure the purpose or function, but that's part of the reason we're going to conduct our research here, and we're looking towards doing various projects. We have three major projects, but two involve this. One of the things that we're doing is, because we're not sure exactly what they are, and there are a lot of, debates, sort of about what they are. But for now, we're calling them cross-domain bacteria because they seem to act like bacteria. But what we want to do is, one of the things we're trying to get is something called an API strip. And what this is a strip, and it's almost just sort of like a piece of cardboard. Very expensive piece of cardboard. It costs like $10 or $25 a piece. But it has little wells in it, and they change color and can be either positive or negative. There's about 30 wells on there. And you put a little bit of the CDB or any bacteria in each of one of these wells on this strip, and it will tell you what the closest strain is. So that's sort of our next step, is we're going to try to see whether there's a match for these against any known strain. But just by examination on size and behavior, there is no match. But we'd like to know a little bit more about them. So that's one of the things that we're asking for in our donation drive, is to get an API strip to identify what strain, if any, these cross-domain bacteria are. And my suspicion is that we're going to find out that they're hybrid, or that they're made from gene splicing, that they have maybe a gene from one bacteria and then some genes from some fungus and then some genes from, you know, a plant and then, you know, all combined together, maybe with a little bit of nanotechnology to make them do what they do. So that's what we're thinking, but that's sort of the next step is to try to match them.
Right.
And I know we're not going to get a match, but it'll at least tell us a little bit. So that's kind of one of the ways that we're going to try to identify them.
Now, I have a bunch more questions about this, obviously, but is it the potential here then is that you said that it seems to be at this point ubiquitous, which means that we wouldn't be able to get a control sample, something that would not contain this? You can actually compare it to something else? How is that?
That's a great question.
Yeah.
That's been somewhat of an issue. They're not ubiquitous in the sense that, you can't, get some, water and not have them in it. You know, they seem to be ubiquitous in things like commercial food or whether they're plants or animals, pretty much anything that's exposed to the atmosphere. But I don't think, I couldn't be sure, but, for example, scientific grade, saline, I don't think is going to have these in them, and they don't seem to. So they're not everywhere, but they're everywhere in living creatures, it seems, or at least the ones we've looked at so far on this page, which I guess would be calf liver, potato, carrot, and pig lung. They're in those. So
right. And some of this then was just the random thing that you could get, or the carrot, for example, something you got over the regular grocery store or grown out of someone's garden?
I couldn't tell you. I wasn't involved in picking any of these things. Clifford would be able to speak to that more specifically, but I think that he just wanted to check, and he put it under the microscope and found them there. But controls are an issue, and we're working very hard to make sure that all of our experiments have good controls on them.
Right.
So,
yep.
So we can do controls. It's just that, because these things are everywhere, we just have to be careful that, that we don't, have them end up in our control samples. But it's not impossible.
So what kind of behavior would you say, if I can use that term, do they have? Have you studied what they actually do, these things?
Well, that's something we're trying to figure out. The first thing we want to know is what they're made of. And we want to know what the out, because they're very resistant to degradation. They're not like normal cells. They can withstand extremes of temperature and pH. So we want to know what the exterior is made out of in terms of the surface. We stain them, and they stain as a quote-unquote gram-negative bacteria, but certainly I don't know of any gram-negative bacteria that has properties like this. So we want to know what they're made out of, essentially. So we want to see what the surface is made out of and why they're so resistant, and we'd like to actually see whether they have protein in them. And preliminarily, it looks like they do, which would suggest, these aren't, like titanium Terminator 2 liquid metal cells.
Right.
It suggests they're biological, but
right.
that doesn't rule out nanotechnology. Certainly, it doesn't rule it out. But
sure.
They,
yeah.
It do look so, and I believe Clifford also isolated DNA from them, which is a real breakthrough. And so that suggests that they're more on the genetic engineering side of things than the pure nanotechnology side of things. But, for example, the surface of them, we're really looking to consider that the surface may not be a conventional bacterial surface, that maybe this is something else. But it's just too early to tell about that. So that's kind of the way that we're going in terms of identifying them. But in terms of your original question and behavior, we want to kind of like know some basics about them. Do they contain protein? What else do they contain? Another question that we might want to know is, if they contain protein and DNA, they have to have a way to make the protein. And every form of life uses something called a ribosome, which is basically a protein factory. It's in all cells. So we'd like to know that as well, but we don't know that yet. But in terms of behavior, that's really all very up in the air at this point. They seem to, let's see if I can talk about this. All right, so they seem to form a property called biofilms, which are common to bacteria. And that's basically where bacteria just all stick together, and they act as sort of like a co-op, more or less.
Right. Yep.
So that they can also signal one another, and so it's a sort of like a bacterial colony that's on this sort of sticky surface, and they secrete sort of this sticky nutrient surface to live on, and it helps keep them alive and protects them from competing organisms or, you know, anything that might hurt them. But what's interesting about biofilms in just regular biology is that these biofilms have properties like they're almost like they're swarm intelligence, because even regular bacteria, they can signal each other. So, for example, if a bacteria in a biofilm, if something attacks it, it can signal all the other bacteria in the biofilm, hey, somebody's invading, you know, let's all modulate our gene expression together. And so that's a property of biofilms, that it's almost like an apartment complex for bacteria with really good, you know, connectivity between all of the different compartments. So
right.
That would be one behavior. The other important behavior that has been observed is that it seems that these, well, there's two. One is that it seems that that they're inside the filaments. We've seen that, and we've also seen that they sort of sometimes like line up, you know, in a line that almost, you know, looks like a filament. And so it seems, and we're not sure about any of this, but that the behavior is sort of, you know, that they, under the certain conditions, that they maybe turn into the filaments, or that they assemble the filaments and then become part of it. So that's the second part of the behavior. And then the third that's been observed, that's published, is that the state of them in the blood. And for that paper, you'd be on the same page on carnicom.com, and you would scroll down, and I believe, let's see, well, I have to find it, but I believe that it is in one of these papers down here. I'll get back to you on that with that one, but there is a paper on these where you can see, it's on my my website, biocode.info. There's pictures, and they surround red blood cells
right
in the blood.
Yeah.
And they almost, it's like, you know, I don't know how many, but say 10 or 15 are all around a single red blood cell, like almost stuck to them, looking like they're trying to get in, or, you know, whatever. I'm not sure what that means, but those are the behaviors we've observed. So, you know, and then also, yeah, it's going to be a tough mystery to solve, but we're going to do our best to solve it. Because especially by looking at these CDB, rather than focusing on, you know, we want to focus on Morgellons, so to speak, and there are a lot of people that suffer from that, and, you know, it's a real tragedy, but the same time, if we can help everybody by looking at the root, you know, cause, the core component of this thing that they're spraying, at least the very smallest unit that we can analyze, and that's living, then that offers a potential route not only to identifying it, through, you know, potentially sequencing the DNA from it and maybe finding out what it's related to, but also in terms of therapies, because if, you know, you're able to disable the fundamental, you know, almost nano-assembler or nano-machine, if you will, not that it's a machine, it's more like biological, but you can think of it like a little, almost like a helper, it seems its function is. Well, if we could disable that, you know, then there's, of course, a lot of avenues that open up in terms of therapy, as well as identification of who's responsible. You know, especially when we get these genes, DNA sequences, we can see where it came from. So
it's kind of like if you zoom in there, you'll find a little like a little logo stamp, just like in Blade Runner. You sort of like the Tyrell Corporation logo.
Right. That's a great, you know, that is a great movie. I love the movie.
Yeah. It's great.
Blade Runner. And it's very prophetic.
Indeed.
To be frank with you, actually, the first publicly known, fully synthetic bacteria was created, a couple of years ago, by a private scientist, and he,
Craig Venter,
yeah. He watermarked the DNA in this thing?
Yeah, exactly. I remember that.
He watermarked the DNA in it, and I think he patented or copyrighted it. So, you know, the whole watermarking thing is not very far-fetched because it's already happened.
Yep.
but in terms of identification, there are public databases where you can, it's almost like a search engine, where if you have a DNA sequence, it's called BLAST, B-L-A-S-T, BLAST, and you can take a sequence, a little fragment of DNA, just in letters, you know, C-A-T-T-T, whatever, and put it into BLAST, and it'll tell you what comes up as a match that's in the public databases. So that's what I mean. We might be able to see, well, part of it came from this strain, which came from this creature in this laboratory in 1987. Part of it came from this laboratory in 1994. That's a potential pathway of identification. And it might help with the behavior, because once we can start to see what genes are in there and what proteins are in there, and we're crossing our fingers that it's more protein related, because that'll be easier for us. But, once we know those sorts of things, then saying things like function is a little bit easier, and determining how it works, you know, what its life cycle is. And then from that comes how to interrupt its life cycle. So it's sort of a two-pronged approach there. There's the identification, and then there's also sort of the analysis.
Right. No, exactly. I remember that, 2010, in May, we published that article that Craig Venter creates first synthetic life form, and he describes how he, you know, did this kind of little watermark there. But he also says, I read a paragraph here quickly, we were static when the cells booted up with all the watermarks in place, Dr. Venter told The Guardian. It's a living species now, part of our planet's inventory of life. You know, so who knows what someone has made somewhere. I mean, obviously, this seems to be connected to a bigger idea of this being sprayed, as you kind of connected the dots earlier there. But nonetheless, if we're talking about something that's self-replicating, for example, which is also a possibility, this is something that could have begun in America, let's say, experiment there, and soon enough, this is something that might spread to the entire globe, you know?
Right, and yeah, that's a point that's under consideration, and I wish I had some good answers, but I don't. At this point, we have the evidence to link the aerosol spraying and the fibers from that. We can link that to, oral filaments in the gums or in the soft tissue in the mouth. We can link that via multiple methods of confirmation, mostly which involve spectrophotometry. And I won't bore you with the details, but that is a link there to the fibers that they spray versus the fibers you can get from your mouth. And then there's also a link between what they spray as well as the changes to our blood in terms of the spectra. And that's actually something that a personal research project of mine, and I actually just got the equipment for it. It arrived today, a spectrophotometer. So pretty soon here, I'm going to start analyzing the spectra of blood. But yeah, absolutely. You know, the whole Craig Venter thing with the bacteria. You know, we don't know whether it's transmissible. In the sense that, you know, well, they're spraying it. You know, can it be transmitted from, if you eat a carrot that has these in it, does that cause an infection? You know,
yeah.
So forth.
Yeah.
And so we don't have any good answers, because the thing is that if it's so ubiquitous and it's so widespread at this point, why do they still continue spraying? And so that's one of the core questions and the core mystery about all of this. Besides, you know, can these things infect, you know, on their own, or do they need, you know, the assistance of raw material that's being sprayed from the air every
right.
other day?
Yeah.
That's what we don't know. And just, you know, on my I'm not speaking for the Carnicom Institute, but my personal opinion is that the only logical explanation that I can come up with is that there is something in the air that they're spraying that helps either control
right.
what is already spread and or provide raw material of what's already spread, because we know that, you know, in addition to these biologicals, that there are various heavy metal salts in this spray that they're the aerosol, the chemtrails, if you will, that they're spraying. So those are all excellent questions, but we don't have the answers yet. But hopefully over the next year or so, we might have some better answers. We have a whole research plan for the next year. So.
Well, great. Well, that's very interesting. Exactly. We have to touch base again here and see what happens, you know, because that's very interesting. But I'm glad you guys are on top of this and looking into this. Now, have you in any capacity attempted to destroy the bacteria?
Yes. And Clifford managed to extract DNA from them.
Any results on that, by the way, either?
The DNA thing is complex. So 2 points. The first is that if Clifford, and it does seem he managed to extract the DNA, and that's the third or fourth paper down called DNA isolated. If he's got it, and I think he does, then that means he managed to crack them open. I'm not privy to the details of that procedure, but apparently it was very complex and involved. And involved all sorts of techniques. So I think he did manage to crack some of them open. So they're not entirely impervious. It's just difficult, not impossible. So that was your first question. And then your second question, with the DNA, what do we do with it? DNA sequencing is not an easy thing, and it's a rather expensive proposition. So we've had problems in the past with labs giving us fake data that we know to be wrong. So, you know, there's the paradox, you know, do you send it into a lab or whatever? So although we have the DNA, you know, we're starting to look into methods of not sequencing the entire genome, because that's very, very difficult and very expensive, but perhaps sequencing parts of it, just a small part of it. And that's part of kind of what the research is moving towards. But I wish there was something that we could afford that's not, you know, $2 million where we could just drop the DNA and out comes the sequence.
Right.
I wish it was that simple, it's not quite.
Yeah, we've talked with many people about various, findings and things like that in terms of they've been trying to analyzing DNA of different, different types of skulls that have been found in different ways. And we've gone through many times the ordeal of just, sequencing some of this DNA, and again, it's getting cheaper all the time, of course, because more of these machines are out there now where you can do it, but nonetheless, it's still not a walk in the park, you know?
Right, and also the other problem with this particular thing is that we're dealing with what appears to be an organism that has been genetically engineered, and I can't say that as a fact, but it's very strong evidence that that's the case. Sequencing it, you know, you send a bacteria into a lab, well, there's various methods, but they know it's a conventional bacteria. Well, we don't know, essentially, there's things like primers and so forth that you have to know ahead of time, not only amplify, but also begin sequencing the DNA. So you have to know a little bit about it before you start, you know, doing the sequencing. And the problem is this is an entirely new form of life, is what it seems. So we're not sure, you know, whether even if we put it in a $2 million machine, if it's completely different from anything it's seen, it might not be able to start the reaction, essentially, because the primers, essentially the first part of that DNA sequence, it's almost like think of it like the PIN number, right? The PIN number of the DNA is different than all of the other known forms of life. So now you've got to start sort of guessing at that PIN number in order to start getting it to be analyzed. So,
right.
So that's another challenge.
Now, I have many more questions for you, Vincent, about all of this and the connections to both the chemtrails and the possible you know, agenda here of what basically is going on, and we can certainly speculate a little bit more in the second segment as we carry on here. But why don't we talk a little bit about your websites here first and give out some of those details again before we take a short break here between the segments. And I also wanted to, of course, ask you if you guys are seeking to seeking support, basically, to continue the research and everything else. So please give us all the details here.
Sure, absolutely. You can get to the Carnicom Institute's website. I gave you guys a shortcut link earlier to the papers, but the main website is carnicominstitute.org. That's carnicominstitute.org. Okay, and that's the Carnicom Institute. And then my personal website that I have just got up and running recently is BioCode, and the link is biocode.info. So BioCode.info. And there I'll be posting my own research, which, you know, maybe tangentially affiliated or unaffiliated with the Carnicom Institute, with my, you know, own equipment that I've acquired. And then in terms of support, absolutely, I would encourage anyone listening that's interested. The Carnicom Institute is one of the few organizations that's capable of doing this analysis and does it objectively without trying to do disinformation, you know, to the public. And it's an entirely scientific endeavor. So we do need help with various projects. The one that I would encourage is what I mentioned earlier, the bacterial analysis. We need something called API strips. And those things are going to cost us, oh, either $250 to $500 for a pack of 25, I think. And we'd like to get some of those. So I will put the link to that donation on my blog. So if anyone wants to help us out with that, you check my blog.
Well, exactly. Please do that, because that's not a lot. And, you know, we should be able to pull together and have that to you guys here soon, because that's it's really important, you know, if we want to see the carrying on of this. So, yeah, great stuff.
Yeah. Thank you for having me. I really appreciate the opportunity to chat with you. And I would also encourage the audience to check out Sophia Smallstorm's presentation on synthetic biology. You can search for it on YouTube, and it's also on my blog. She has some very excellent points about this whole process if you're interested.
All right, very good. Carnicominstitute.org, biocode.info. We're going to have some other links up to the donations, and of course check out the program we did with Sophia Smallstorm as well on this very topic. But we'll pick up after the break. Much more to come to here. A very interesting guy, so stay with us. We'll be right back. We have much more coming up with Vincent Freeman in the second hour, as I will get a chance to get to most of my questions about these findings and the possibilities about what we are looking at. We discuss what it is composed of, what inhibits the growth of the cross-domain bacteria. We talk about if it can be remotely controlled, and that might sound kind of stupid or bizarre, but the fact is this might be an artificial intelligence that might be the product of a kind of intelligence that we do not yet know about. We also discuss the possibility that this is a bacteria that has survived outer space and has only recently arrived. In other words, an extraterrestrial life form. Lastly, we tackle symptoms and possible ways to detect it and see if you have it in you. We'll pick this up on redeyesmembers.com right after the break. If you're not yet a subscriber and have full access to our archives, please take a look at all the programs and videos that we have for you on the members' website and sign up for a 3-month subscription. Try it out. It's only about the price of 2 cups of coffee per month, and you'll get access to well over 800 radio programs and videos on some interesting off-the-wall and, of course, captivating topics that you want to learn more about if you're interested in all the topics that we discuss. Don't miss the latest Radio 314 program with Johnny Enoch and the War on Kratom. We have upcoming on Red Eyes Radio Ingunn Sigurdsdottir from Norway to break down the myth that Norway's the best country in the world. Then we have John B. Wells, Catherine Austin Fitz, Chip Tatum with Ulla Damagård, Robert Morningstar, and Zoltan Istvan for a pro-transhumanist perspective. Thank you for listening, guys and gals. We'll pick this right up on redeyesmembers.com.